Has been no word from the White House on who might be nominated to replace her. Justice O'Connor's resignation is expected to set off a major conflict over who will succeed her. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins me now. Good morning, Nina.
Morning, Renee.
So, Nina, I think this is a surprise announcement. How was it made?
It was actually made at the court, but it is a surprise because we have all been waiting for Chief Justice Rehnquist, who's 80 and who's been quite ill with thyroid cancer, to retire. And nothing happened this week, and nothing happened this week. And then suddenly, today, as the week drew to a close, came word that Justice O'Connor, who is in the best of health and at 75 appears to be at the top of her game intellectually on the court, is leaving and will retire from the court, leaving a critical vacancy because she has been a swing vote on so many issues, and really the balance of power at the court sits with Justice O'Connor in many, many cases, and with her departure, the balance of the power at the court is at stake.
And is there anything you know at this time as to why she might resign at this time?
Her husband has been quite ill, and I think, and I'm just speculating here, their roots are in Arizona. He's been spending a lot of time in her chambers because he's not really able to be at home alone. And so she, I assume, decided that they should go back to Arizona and she should spend some quality time, as they say, with him. She still has a very big schedule set out for the next year of public appearances and travel on behalf of the United States representing the Supreme Court and the idea of judicial independence and discussions with judges in other countries. But she can still do that, obviously, and still spend more time in Arizona with her husband as well.
Well, as you've said, Justice O'Connor was a critical part of this court in the sense that she was a swing vote. What kind of justice will President Bush be looking for to replace Sandra Day O'Connor?
The president has said that his model for a Supreme Court justice is Justice Antonin Scalia, Justice Clarence Thomas, and those are the two most conservative members of the court, and that one has to expect that that's what he wants. Now, there's been a lot of talk in Washington about the president appointing Alberto Gonzalez to the Supreme Court. He would be the first Hispanic member of the Supreme Court, and there's a lot of political pluses to that. Some conservatives don't like Gonzalez because they say it's Spanish for suitor, meaning Spanish for liberal moderate or moderate liberal or unpredictable on some of the key critical issues that are likely to come to the court. But certainly it would make confirmation easier. I should say when I say he would be the first Hispanic justice that some say he would be the second, that Justice Benjamin Cardozo, who was a Sephardic Jew whose family came from Spain in many centuries ago, that he would be the first. He would have been the first Hispanic.
Nina, I'm just going to interrupt you momentarily to say for stations that have not joined us, we are doing special coverage on the Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And that was just a moment for those of you who are just joining us. This is special coverage of the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor from the Supreme Court. We're speaking with NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and also joined by Neil Conan and Don Gagne. And so let's maybe open this discussion out to something that, again, because this is such a surprise, does the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor make it more or less likely that Chief Justice William Rehnquist will retire? Because, of course, that's been all the talk, that he is going to retire.
You know, he's very sick with a very serious form of thyroid cancer. He's been heroic in his performance all year, returning to the bench in March, returning to the court to preside over the internal conferences in December. And I'm told, although I haven't confirmed this, that he's told his law clerks to appear for work, his new law clerks who would come in the latter part of the summer. So that is that's a small indication of the fact that he doesn't intend to retire at the moment. But he has a trach in his throat. He sounds a little bit like Darth Vader. So he can't. That means he can't swallow. So he's being fed through a feeding tube, and he's quite thin and pale at the moment, although very much, you know, on top of his game to all appearances. But I'm not sure that how long he can continue like this if it doesn't get better, and I'm not sure that it's going to get better.
When talk comes to a retiring a Supreme Court justice, I think the single most uttered word is balance.
Well, that's probably true. You know, there's something to the, if you look at the history of the court, in the 1930s, President Roosevelt came up against a court that kept invalidating his New Deal legislation. He even tried to pack the court and failed. But by the time Roosevelt left office, he had named, I think, 8 of the 9 justices. And for years, conservatives have railed about the current direction of the Supreme Court on some social issues. Now they have the chance to change that direction, and that's why there's going to be such a huge battle in the United States Senate, which is so closely divided.
Don Gagne. I was just going to ask Don Gagne. The president spoke most recently about the possibility of a vacancy on the Supreme Court at a news conference in the Rose Garden in May. We're expecting him in the Rose Garden in a few minutes to comment on today's developments. But, Don, what did he say in May?
Right, and we will not get an announcement from him today, we're told, on who a nominee will be. But he said, I'm quoting here, the president from May 31st, I'm obviously going to spend a lot of time reviewing the records of a variety of people and looking at their opinions and their character, and will consult with members of the United States Senate at the appropriate time. Well, this would be the appropriate time.
And what would be the procedure here? The president would presumably then want to take some time to make these consultations, make a decision, and announce a decision, but that doesn't mean that the process then immediately gets underway, does it?
No, it does not. Especially the president is leaving the country next week as well. He's going to the G8 summit in Scotland. He's stopping in Denmark. So he has a full plate. But we also know that there has been a team of people working on this, pulling names together, again, already looking over the records of various potential nominees. It's something they've been doing for years, frankly, knowing that it would come to a head this summer, or likely come to a head this summer. But again, we expected perhaps Rehnquist first.
I wonder if they had any advance notice at the White House from Justice O'Connor. We don't know the answer to that. My inclination would be to think that they didn't, and that they're as surprised as we are, and that their list for chief is not exactly the same as the list for an associate justice.
Well it might be good to know right now that President Bush is expected to speak in just minutes. That's the expectation about the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor. And when he does, we will go to that. But let's continue this conversation. Neil, you were just going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say it is a sweltering day here in Washington, D.C. Nevertheless, President Bush is expected to emerge outside into the Rose Garden to make these remarks. We've already seen emerging from the Oval Office several senior officials of his administration, Vice President Cheney, Karl Rove, his senior associate, and now here's the president emerging from the Oval Office and approaching the bank of microphones set up in the White House Rose Garden. And here is President Bush.
Good morning. A short time ago, I had a warm conversation with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who has decided to retire from the Supreme Court of the United States. America is proud of Justice O'Connor's distinguished service, and I'm proud to know her. Today, she has the gratitude of her fellow citizens, and she and John and their family have our respect and good wishes. Sandra Day O'Connor joined the nation's highest court in 1981 as the first woman ever appointed to that position. Throughout her tenure, she has been a discerning and conscientious judge and a public servant of complete integrity. Justice O'Connor's great intellect, wisdom, and personal decency have won her the esteem of her colleagues and our country. Under the Constitution, I am responsible for nominating a successor to Justice O'Connor. I take this responsibility seriously. I will be deliberate and thorough in this process. I have directed my staff, in cooperation with the Department of Justice, to compile information and recommend for my review potential nominees who meet a high standard of legal ability, judgment, and integrity, and who will faithfully interpret the Constitution and laws of our country. As well, I will continue to consult, as will my advisors, with members of the United States Senate. The nation deserves, and I will select, a Supreme Court justice that Americans can be proud of. The nation also deserves a dignified process of confirmation in the United States Senate, characterized by fair treatment, a fair hearing, and a fair vote. I will choose a nominee in a timely manner so that the hearing and the vote can be completed before the new Supreme Court term begins. Today, however, is a day to honor the contributions of a fine citizen and a great patriot. Many years ago, Sandra Day O'Connor chose the path of public service, and she served with distinction as a legislator and a judge in Arizona before joining the Supreme Court. When President Ronald Reagan appointed Justice O'Connor 24 years ago, Americans had high expectations of her, and she has surpassed those expectations in the performance of her duties. This great lady, born in El Paso, Texas, rose above the obstacles of an earlier time and became one of the most admired Americans of our time. She leaves an outstanding record of service to the United States, and our nation is deeply grateful. Thank you.
President Bush concluding some brief remarks in the Rose Garden of the White House, emerged just a few moments ago to issue some very warm words of thanks for the long public service of Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who announced her resignation earlier today. The president spoke of her wisdom, her integrity, a great lady, he described her, noting that she was born in El Paso, Texas. Of course, she made much of her career in the state of Arizona. And the president appeared to make some opening shots in confirmation process. He said he would direct his staff to talk about some potential nominees that he would be consulting with the Senate. But Don Gagne, NPR White House correspondent, he talked about a dignified process with fair treatment, a fair hearing, and a fair vote.
Yes, he expects whomever he puts forward to not encounter the kind of troubles some of his nominees to the federal bench have encountered. In fact, it was what led to the huge battle over the past couple of years in the Senate over some of the more conservative nominees, some though that many Democrats felt were unacceptable. We had just in the past, how long has it been now? About a month, 6 weeks or something like that, a deal that was reached under which the Democratic senators agreed not to filibuster judicial nominees. And
except in extraordinary circumstances.
There's the phrase. Yes, exactly. So we'll see how that plays out. But you're right. It was kind of a word of warning in 3-minute remarks that were mostly aimed at praising Justice O'Connor to the Senate. Just a bit of a warning from the president.
And Nina Totenberg, Arlen Specter, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the spotlight is also suddenly thrown upon him. He just assumed that office this term. His staff has also been working in anticipation of Supreme Court vacancy. Perhaps not this vacancy, Nina, but they are also going to be looking ahead to this process. And it was interesting that the president said that he intends to back time this entire process to propose his nomination in time for the Senate to hold hearings, consider, and have a vote, and install a new member of the United States Supreme Court, presumably by the first Monday in October.
Well, they're definitely going to try to do that. Senator Specter said to me a couple of weeks ago that no matter what the vacancy, he thought the hearings would likely be in early September. The majority leader, Bill Frist, has said he wanted them earlier. I can't see how they can do them before late August. The Democrats would raise a real stink because they need to nominate somebody. So let's assume that happens early next week. And the nomination goes to the Senate by the end of the week. They're in recess right now, although they'll start to work on it. And they need at least a month, or probably normally they have. If you look back at historically, there's been a period of actually 6 to 8 weeks from nomination to hearings before they've actually had the hearings. So unless they change that dramatically, and I'm not sure that they can, we're talking about hearings that start in late August, early September, and hopefully with a vote on the Senate floor. But if it's a very controversial nominee, the Democrats undoubtedly will try to filibuster.
We would like to remind listeners now that you are listening to special coverage from NPR News on the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor from the Supreme Court. The word has just come out in the last hour and a few minutes. And we will continue with this coverage. Now, we have this 1992 recording of Justice O'Connor giving the court's decision in the case Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And that was a ruling that reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, the landmark decision that said a woman has a constitutional right to an abortion. Let's listen to this cut of Sandra Day O'Connor.
And we conclude that the central holding of Roe should be reaffirmed. Some of us as individuals find abortion offensive to our most basic principles of morality, but that can't control our decision. Our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. We reaffirm the constitutionally protected liberty of the woman to decide to have an abortion before the fetus attains viability and to obtain it without undue interference from the state. We also hold the state has legitimate interests from the outset of pregnancy in protecting the health of the mother and the life of the fetus that may become a child, and that the state may further these interests so long as it does not unduly burden the woman's right to choose.
A woman's right to choose. That's a very key expression. Nina, what can you tell us about Justice O'Connor's vote in this case, and what does it tell us about her tenure as a Supreme Court justice?
Well, I think there are still 5 votes on the court to uphold a woman's right to choose because Justice Kennedy voted with her in that case, as did Justice Souter. But we're now down to 5-4, and Justice Kennedy has voted to support many, many curbs on abortion, including so-called partial birth, late term, whatever we want to call it. He's voted to uphold those curbs, and they're going to come up again. So I would imagine that the question now really is not only whether Roe is upheld in its entirety or whether it's essentially chipped away into almost nothing of a guarantee under the Constitution. Justice O'Connor was sort of the critical vote, the bulwark on this case. And her test, the test she devised, which is, does a regulation or a law pose an undue burden on a woman's right to choose, that became the test of the majority of the court, in essence. When she first announced it, it was only her test, and it was a little bit less than Roe versus Wade, but it became the test for the court. Now the question is whether that undue burden is going to get stretched considerably.
And joining us now to continue this conversation is Alan Morrison. He teaches at the Stanford Law School, and he's argued more than a dozen cases in front of Justice O'Connor. Tell us, did you see this resignation coming?
No, I certainly did not. There had been rumors for some time. In fact, as far as the 2000 election that Justice O'Connor might step aside, I knew that her husband had not been in good health, but I thought that the most likely, almost certain resignation would be that of the Chief Justice, and that appears to be incorrect.
As did many people. What was Justice O'Connor like as a justice? As I said, you argued cases before her.
Yes, the first thing about Justice O'Connor is that she almost always asked a question very early in the argument, and it was often a question about some detail about the record. If the question was, is something an undue burden, as Nina just mentioned on the abortion issues, she would want to know the details about what actually the record showed about burden or not. As I used to tell other advocates when I would help prepare them for argument, the one word you want to never say before Justice O'Connor is never. She liked to look at everything in great detail and in the facts and circumstances of the case, and she always had good questions, and they were not rhetorical. They were questions she needed to know the answer to help her decide the case.
She was often considered a swing vote on the court. Was that expected when she was appointed? when she was approved?
I don't think that anyone had any notion at all that she would be the swing vote at that time. In the last few years, she's had some major swing vote positions, particularly on affirmative action. But rather interestingly, this last term, she was not in the majority on most of these cases as she had been in the past. The sentencing guidelines case, she was in the minority. She was in the minority on the juvenile death penalty. In the takings case last week involving New London, Connecticut, she was in the minority on one half of the Ten Commandments case, and she wrote a vigorous dissent in the medical marijuana case. So people will speculate about why she stepped aside. People thought that she would stay on because she had so much power, but perhaps she thought, well, I'm in the minority. I don't have the power that I had, and there are other things, including her family, which she mentioned in her letter.
Given all the talk of the possible retirement of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, how will the nomination process to replace Justice O'Connor be different, if it will, from that if had Mr. Rehnquist resigned?
Well, the first thing is there's not going to be the possibility of having two confirmation battles. If the Chief Justice had resigned and the President had chosen to try to elevate one of the current Associate Justices, we would have had what we had in 1986, a battle for the Chief Justice, the moving over, plus for the filling of the vacancy. Now we'll only have one nomination and one vacancy to fill, assuming the Chief Justice does not also resign. The second thing is, my own guess is that the President will have a little more freedom to nominate somebody who is younger rather than somebody who was a little bit older for the position of Associate Justice. It would have been perhaps a little awkward to have somebody 15 years or 20 years or 25 years younger than many of the justices suddenly become the Chief Justice. That will not be a problem, nominating somebody to be the Associate Justice. And I might say that one of the big changes is Justice Breyer, who has been the junior justice for the last 11 years, will right. No longer be the junior justice, will no longer have to answer the door at the conference and do all the other things that the most junior justice does.
Thanks very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Alan Morrison teaches at Stanford Law School. You've been listening to an NPR News special report. For continuing coverage of this story, stay tuned to this public radio station.
And, of course, we'll have more in the noon hour of the afternoon magazine on the resignation today of Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor here on WILL Urbana, AM 580, and online at will.uiuc.edu. It's 10:29. In just a moment, we'll join the first hour of Focus 580 in Progress, a rebroadcast of a May 24th interview that Todd Gleason conducted with Peter Goldsmith, Assistant Professor and NSRL Endowed Fellow in Agriculture Strategy in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics at U of I, and Bill Wolf, President of Wolf & Associates Incorporated, Newcastle, Virginia, about the book How the United States Department of Agriculture's Redefinition of the Word Organic Changed the Industry. In the 11 o'clock hour this morning, the topic will be this year's Farm Progress Show. Stuart Ellis of the U of I Cooperative Extension Service and show manager Matthew Youngman will be Todd's guests. Now let's join Todd's May 24th interview with Peter Goldsmith and Bill Wolf in Progress.
Are they coming from the industry itself? Are they coming from independent research? And this is very, very important. I think this is maybe the next wave of activity in organic, is trying to provide some formality and rigor to the process, and whether it is in fact better for you, or in other cases it may not be, because it may have higher, because you might not be able to use a bactericide or some product, it may be have higher bacteria loads or whatever. But the point is that scientific and research is really, really important, and would serve only help organic to make its way in the marketplace.
We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Good morning to you. Do you have a question?
Yes. I have recently retired from farming, and for the last 8 years, I had 30 acres of certified organic acreage down in Douglas County. And it was an interesting experience. I learned a lot, and it was also quite frustrating, and the whole thing abounds in ironies. One of the things when I first got into it was the promise of being able to sell organic soybeans for $18 to $22 a bushel, you know, forever. And at the time, some of my friends at the university were saying, well, you know, China has vast acreage there that has never been treated chemically, and they're going to certify, and they have got, you know, low cost of labor, and, you know, your soybean market is going to disappear. And, you know, indeed, by the time I had gone through the three-year process, the value of my organic soybeans was down to, you know, $10 to $13 per bushel, which changed the economics, you know, quite dramatically. The thing that I found ironic and frustrating was the organic movement, which is, what, several generations old probably now, originally had a vision of some alternative agriculture to the industrial model, which is where our country was headed at the time. But at the end of the process, in order to preserve the value of their branding, which they had worked at for several generations, you have to have controls so that people know what the brand means. But the result was a pile of regulations when I went through the certification process. You had a group of people who were essentially anti-bureaucratic, people who wanted to work in the soil, spending huge amounts of time learning the minutiae of the regulations on what you could and couldn't do. So it ends up being a kind of a bureaucratic nightmare to maintain your certification. And then the other frustration I had was, and I can't address the nutritional side of it, but on the production side, I found myself in a morally compromised situation because I did and do care about the soil and soil quality. And a lot of the soil quality problems that we have here in central Illinois really came from that 100 years of farming, which was organic, and the only method of weed control was cultivation. So that rather than a best practices approach, because the definition of organic, you know, focused on this distinction between synthesized chemicals and naturally occurring chemicals, I found that I was required to really beat up the soil in order to have any chance of raising a crop. And where in my conventional crops, using a minimum tillage approach and a judicious use of chemicals, I could raise a crop and be profitable with two tillage passes. On the organic side, you know, I was getting up to 8 or 10 tillage passes, which hurts the organic matter, organic content in the soil. Every time you till, you oxidize organic matter and so on. And so I found oftentimes the organic is sold as this kind of idealized system where you can do no harm if you follow the organic approach, and you only do harm if you use any synthesized chemicals. And so I found a kind of straitjacket there made me do things that I knew were bad for the soil, but I had to do it because it was the only way to maintain my organic certification. I have a lot of other things I could talk about, too, but that's probably enough for now.
Caller, if you want to hang on the line just a bit, I'd like for you to stay in the conversation simply because you've done this in the past. We do have a caller from Wisconsin on line two as well, and I do want to get them in and see if we can have them ask the question. Oh, we cannot. Can we put both of them online at the same time? Well, I'm getting to know, so we'll have to let you go, and we'll comment on what you've had to say here in just a bit, but from Wisconsin, they've been online for quite some time, and since they're calling in from Wisconsin, I want to make sure that I don't run their long-distance bill up too much. Good morning to you, and you have a question. Where are you calling from, by the way, in Wisconsin?
I'm calling from Milwaukee area.
All right. And are you listening on the web or on?
I am. I'm listening on the web.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I actually have a question regarding food products and the USDA seal. I'm wondering if products such as breads are going to be able to continue to use the USDA organic seal under Harvey versus Veneman. And I can take my comments off the air, too.
Thank you very much. And I believe that would be a question, Bill, for you to answer.
Boy, I'd rather talk about the soybeans and how to grow soybeans with the original intent of organic. But the Harvey we haven't talked much about the Harvey case, but there is a lawsuit that has been working its way through the courts that said that the rule itself contained allowance for synthetic compounds in food, in processed foods, that was not in the original law. And the court ruled, in fact, in favor of the plaintiff and ordered the USDA to modify the regulation. What that means is that there were a number of synthetic materials that had been reviewed very carefully through a public process through the National Organic Standards Board that were put on a national list of allowed synthetic materials for use in food processing, things like baking powder, vitamin C, citric acid, some of the things we actually talked about earlier, lecithin, and those materials included even yeast and pectin as a thickening agent. That list is public. It's listed on the web. The chemical reviews for them are quite detailed. And at least for the moment, we are heading towards a change in labeling in which products that currently are labeled with the organic seal, with the USDA organic seal as USDA organic, meaning 95% or more plus use of some of these allowed materials, they would have to drop back to a 70%, made with 70% organic and could not use the USDA seal. There are products on the marketplace, just as there are local producers of produce that aren't shipped long distances, that could still make that claim. I mean, for example, in the Chicago area, there is a bread product that you can find called Nokomis Organic Breads that would still be able to bear the organic seal because they don't use any of these leavening agents. But there are some national brands of organic breads that would have to either reformulate or change the law or drop back to a made-with-organic-wheat formula. So this process of developing the regulation is ongoing and fairly intense in the sense that it's what we're doing is going through a process of vetting exactly what everybody means in a very public way. And I don't think we're going to see a totally stable definition in terms of details for some time. This change that I've just described probably will take another 2 years to be implemented through the courts and through another federal register process.
Listeners, this morning we're talking about, I suppose, for all intents and purposes, the economics of organic production and how that crop is marketed here in the U.S. and other places around the world. If you'd like to phone in with your question, the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Or locally, 217-333-9455.
Yeah, I want to get back. The gentleman from Douglas County raised a number of really, really important issues for those who produce organic products in general, but also specifically for kind of the Illinois, Indiana producers interested in organic grains. And that's that one of the things that was not very clear or made clear to a lot of those producers who wanted to produce specialty crops, or in this case, organic, was that these markets are very, very dynamic, and that premiums rarely in any business stay high forever because buyers just don't like paying high prices. They like paying lower prices for their products that they purchase rather than higher. And also higher premiums attract entrants, whether they be Chinese producers or in Illinois. We have a number of complementary relationships in Argentina in terms of producing organic products to complement the Illinois supply. So there are lots of entrants that come in. And so that what happens over time is that producers always have to, when you're in a differentiated market as opposed to a commodity market, is always be aware that it's going to be very fluid and that things are going to change. And that means, in the case of organic soybeans, becoming more efficient because there's going to be more supply in the market, and it did outstrip demand, and premiums have fallen So that's something that's very, very different than when we produce commodity products, where we pretty much know what's going to happen in terms of the marketing of the crop and the demand that's out there. Marketing in a differentiated product or a specialty product like organic is a challenge, and it's not going to be the same from year to year.
Peter, this is Bill. I'd agree with you to an extent, but the fact is that the soybean premium has stayed up there to a great extent. The current feedstock price for soybeans for organic is in the $14.75 range in the Minneapolis market. And for tofu, it's $20 to $22 for tofu type. And if you were growing natto beans, you'd get $35 to $40. My feeling about the gentleman, I don't want to... who is growing the 30 acres in Douglas County, is that the key issue is setting things up with a buyer in advance. China soybeans have not been that successful in entering the U.S. There's been talk of it, but the fact is that between shipping and other issues, even the Brazilian soybeans have not dominated the market here. There's a huge new demand for organic soy because of the huge growth in organic dairy and in organic meat products and in organic hog products. So the demand has actually continued fairly strong, and there was actually a soybean shortage this past year in organic because of the weak crop production. And my feeling is that a lot of this has to do with growing technique. That cultivation discussion is about learning the timing of planting and learning about intercropping and new and interesting methods to grow beans, even using organic methods that don't use tillage. There is some good research going on at universities, and then there's institutes like the Michael Fields Institute, Michael Fields Agricultural Research Institute, that are working with the University of Wisconsin. So I think that there's two things there: the production method and learning those tools, and then finding your market connections, whether it's value added or contracting, because people are still making good money as organic farmers.
Bill, which does your consulting firm work with mostly, the producer-supplier end or the end-user side? And if it's the end-user, what kind of clientele list do you have?
We work with farmer groups. We work with companies like Driscoll Strawberry. I've done work helping them develop their organic berries. We've done work with the Foreign Agricultural Service on their international standards. We've worked with food companies who are looking to develop products. I'll disclose that I've done some work with the Michael Fields Institute and the Nokomis Bakery I mentioned, mm-hmm. because I've seen them working directly with farmers to contract to link the farmer to the food to the consumer. I do some work, volunteer with some food co-ops like the Roanoke Natural Foods Co-op here to connect local produce growers with local restaurants.
We have more callers on the line. Line 1 is joining us now to ask a question. Good morning to you. What is your question, please?
I'm the person from Douglas County.
Oh, sure.
Called in earlier, and then you went on to the Wisconsin. And,
yes.
You know, I'm interested in their perspective on some of the issues in terms of sticking with a narrow definition of organic rather than best practices, because I think for a lot of consumers, there simply is a lot of confusion about what those distinctions might be. And, you know, the one thing I have to say, because one of your experts was referring to the research that's being done on alternative methods to raising organic soybeans and so on without relying on the tillage. And, you know, one thing that is an unequivocal benefit from the organic movement is that it has spurred a lot of research now that there is a branded market for organic. And I think even here at the University of Illinois, 20 years ago, there likely was almost no interest in organic production methods, and I'm aware that now there is. And so I think everyone benefits from broadening the field of research. But from the perspective of someone in central Illinois, central Indiana, in this area, if they're not interested in crop to table produce. And some people are, but, you know, let's be honest about that. To do that in this area, you're looking at an economic lifestyle that the majority of their customers would not be willing to live on. You know, I buy organic produce at the Urbana Market, and you know, I know a bit about the sacrifices these people make financially in order for me to have a lovely organic salad. But for your Central Illinois farmers in this corn and soybean and wheat belt, you can't go and, in advance of the process, lock up a market for your soybeans that's going to be predictable. I was a part of a movement to start an organic marketing co-op here. And the buyers, the dairy farmers who are buying my organic corn, were undercapitalized. Rather than being able to deliver my crop and get a check the same day or within several days, which you can with the commodity crops, I waited months and sometimes months and months, you know, 6 months to collect. So people need to be aware that it's true. The desire for organic milk drives the need for organic corn. But, you know, it's a tough, tough way to go. And in the end, I would like to have milk that is free of hormones. I would like to have beef that's hormone-free. But, of course, that can be done without requiring that everything in the food chain down the line, say, requiring it, that organic grain be fed to that beef. I don't know if there's any studies that would show that organic corn produces a better quality of beef than non-organic corn if the other parameters are the same. No antibiotics, no growth hormones.
Is your question that you want clarification between what USDA's rules and regulations say organic is today and what, for instance, the Organic Crop Improvement Association had said prior to that on certification? Is that right?
Well,
I mean, because one was more stringent than the other.
I mean, I think one of the questions that the call raises is important about the certification of one set of practices. While it should be known that the USDA certifies all sorts of brand claims. Natural, hormone-free, whatever a company comes along and wants to make a claim, they sit there and make sure that that the claim is in fact true, and there is a whole third-party certification, et cetera, et cetera. So organic is just one of many sorts of programs that the USDA is now involved in as the market has moved from commodities to differentiated products. They had to come in and provide some discipline, and that's what they do. They are not saying that one is better than the other. That's left to the consumer and left to the research community.
Yeah. The fellow in Douglas County, I'm sorry, I don't know your first name.
Danny.
Danny, I think your question about this best practices versus the synthetics versus natural is a tough one. It's been going, been in discourse, at least in the sustainable agriculture and organic farming community, for 20 years. I agree with you in principle that the thin line there should not be, you know, synthetics bad, natural good, as a rule. And in fact, we attempted to capture that in the law and allow for a process to apply for the use of synthetic compounds that were in line with the 7 written principles in the law for organic management. And there are a number of synthetics that have gone through that process and been added. The challenge is that it is a fairly long process. I think there is some data to show that using natural fertilizers produces a different protein in some crops under some conditions. There's the beginning of that data, and that beginning data indicates that there is actually can be a cellular difference. And that's an exciting part of the puzzle to me. so what Organic was trying to do was really document an entire process. By the way, I really do agree with you that it is a volatile situation, and when you know the ideal is really to, as a farmer, be participating in the value-added piece of the puzzle in some way, or participating with more local farmers in a contract basis. And I've seen some really good models for that. I think Organic Valley, the large farmer co-op of organic dairy farmers, is starting to try to work directly with grain producers to solve the kind of problem you were describing about financing and the payments for grains. On that note, one of the projects we're working on now is the development of a green organic bank to help finance that process.
We have just about 7 minutes left, maybe a little less than that, and two phone calls to get in. We have a caller on line one from here, or on line two from here in Urbana, and one from Bloomington. In Urbana, what's your question, please?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that one caller from Douglas County, and I was thinking, you know, the organic market is not certainly not as large as the overall commercial market, but it still is pretty much a mass market, and mass markets are just tend to be uniform by nature, and so seems to me that bureaucracies are just, you know, part of that, and that if a person just wants to just do some farming and do it the way however they want to, or whatever they think is best, that's not going to, you're not going to be able to sell to a mass market, even if it is the organic mass market. And if you wanted to develop your own, you know, best practices or optimal practices or your own style, I mean, you could maybe make up flyers and you know hand them out to your friends and neighbors, describing, you know, your practices and why they're better or whatever. But that it's just a different kind of a market, and then the marketing, I guess, the style of farming and the style of the marketing seems like they would have to, you know, match each other.
Peter, if you could address that very quickly, and I know you have a program called Market Maker that can be found on the web, and we've got very little time. So.
Yeah, I think the caller is entirely right that when we think about the organic brand and how it competes with other brands and how producers establish brands, that's really just a form of differentiation that producers, it's a difficult, challenging marketing problem to establish yourself as a brand. But it has been done. It's done in Europe quite extensively with origin-based brands that have practices tied to them, and farmers own and control them.
And then very quickly, you have a way actually on the website with your Market Maker?
One of the ways, and we've talked in this conversation a lot about the importance of marketing and beginning with your customer, whether that be a livestock feeder or whether that be a retailer, manufacturer, and understanding their needs. So we've developed a web-based software called marketmaker.com. On the site, it's based on Illinois. It allows suppliers, producers, to look and understand markets, locate customers, and begin to make connections and contacts with them. So that's it's a web-based, map-based piece of software that's been quite successful.
We'll put that up as a disclaimer for me. You and I work together, and part of my job is to know about things like Market Maker and make sure that other people know where that happens to be. Okay, we do have a line four caller on the toll-free calling from Bloomington, Indiana. Good morning, and your question, the final one for the morning.
Good morning. I encourage you to pick up on this program again, but next time do a program on Beyond Organic, because there's a movement of people who have lost their enthusiasm for the organic standards and are moving way beyond that. And this is a topic that is really ripe for presentation and discussion. Are either one of your guests familiar with the phenomenon I'm referring to?
I'm not familiar with it.
I am, and I appreciate and agree with it. I had kind of referenced it earlier when I said that there are other claims that go beyond organic. I think that what I think in the marketplace is that you see the opportunity to have a claim on a product that says it was produced using organic methods, but that its food dollar miles we're local. So there's a local verification, and there's direct marketing, and there is marketing to show that the farmer was treated right. And
well,
there are. So go ahead.
I'm sorry. Going back to the Douglas County farmer, and he touched on this quite wonderfully, and that is the aspect of soil stewardship, because so much of the organic movement is not particularly knowledgeable about soil science. And this is the next hierarchy of extraordinary growing of fruits, vegetables, and grain, and that actually is what my interest is in beyond organic. And there's a group of people who are not satisfied with the do and don'ts, primarily the don'ts of the organic certification and standards, but they're interested in moving way beyond that.
I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to an archive edition of Focus 580. The guest on that particular program, which aired May the 23rd, were Peter Goldsmith, a U of I Extension ag economist, and Bill Wolf of Wolf & Associates. He's out of Newcastle, Virginia. The topic, of course, was organic standards and how USDA's organic standard, put in place in the mid-1990s, changed the organic industry. Coming up in the second hour of Focus 580, we'll take up the Farm Progress Show. Stu Ellis's in studio with us. He's with University of Illinois Extension, and we'll talk with the show site manager for the Farm Progress Show, Matt Youngman. Farm Progress Show coming up at the end of September, and we'll talk at the end of August, I'm sorry, and we'll take up the issue of Farm Progress Show and its brand new show site just outside of Decatur, Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Here's the weather forecast for the two-state region from our own Mike Sola today. He says in the south, mostly cloudy skies, some scattered thunderstorms early, and then it'll be clearing. Elsewhere, becoming mostly sunny, highs ranging from 77 in the far north to around 90 in the far south. Tonight, Mr. Sola says, mostly clear skies, lows ranging from 52 in the north to 62 in southern Indiana. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, the highs tomorrow from 78 in northern Indiana to 86 in southern and western Illinois. The extended forecast.